When Deanna Cooper arrived at Chelsea in 2017, she was, in her own words, a nobody. By the end of the WSL Spring Series, her first campaign as a professional and her first in a Chelsea shirt, everyone in women's football knew exactly who she was. Dubbed the surprise package, as Chelsea went on to win the Spring Series, Cooper was being touted for big things, thanks to her efforts in defence. But ahead of the following WSL season, it all came to an abrupt halt, after she injured her ACL, an injury that effectively put her out for a year. As a result, the defender was unable to break back into the starting 11 at Chelsea, and this summer she moved on to fellow WSL side Reading. But the player arriving at Reading, compared to the player that arrived at Chelsea, is very different. Not just in playing terms, but also as a human being. This is the Women's Football Diary with Deanna Cooper. Deanna, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking some time out and chatting to us on the series as well. First off, how is everything, considering as we record, we're only, 2 weeks away from the start of the new season?
Yeah, thanks for having me, for starters. And things are going really well, to be fair. It's been a bit of a whirlwind few weeks, obviously new club and everything for me. It's going really well. It's good to get to know the new players. Obviously, there's a few new players, not just me, so that's kind of nice. But yeah, it's been a bit of a whirlwind, but really enjoying it and ready to get stuck in. As I say, season starts in 2 weeks, so it's not long now before we all get cracking.
Yeah, definitely. And like you say, even if we're not directly involved in playing, it feels like a whirlwind. There's like football on the TV everywhere you look at the moment. We've got the Women's Champions League final, semi-finals tonight, for example. Yeah. And just kind of shows how jam-packed everything seems to have been after so long off. Yeah. First off, I mean, how does it actually feel to be back playing after so long without it?
Yeah, obviously, when we first stopped, we obviously didn't know if the season was going to be starting, starting back up again. So for me, someone who was kind of in between moving clubs, it's quite difficult because you can't really plan for the future because you might still be where you are. It's really nice just to get back into training every day and back kicking a ball around, because the amount of sessions, I think if you speak to any of the professional women's footballers at the moment, doing running sessions on your own in a park, most of the parks are closed, so sometimes it's on a road and you only have one hour of exercise a day. So that was quite difficult in order to stay in a place where you needed to be, because if the season had come back up, obviously you'd have gone straight back in. So it's just nice to get on a ball and get playing with your teammates and just play football. Like, you don't realize how much you take it for granted until it's kind of taken away. So it is nice to just get back on a ball and just get around other people.
Definitely. In terms of taking things for granted as well, it's something I've asked quite a lot of the athletes we've had on as guests recently, is that when everything is sort of going along as you'd expect it and then it just stops and it's totally out of your control, how do you actually mentally cope with that? You were at Chelsea and Chelsea ended up winning the title in these peculiar, weird circumstances. So how do you actually cope with just everything stopping beyond your control?
To be honest, we had really, really good support. So we was always like quite well informed with regards to what was going on and decisions that were being made within the club at Chelsea. So I didn't really have many worries. They was like, don't worry, we've got everything sorted. So if we do come back in, this is what's going to happen. If we don't come back in, this is what's going to happen. So it kind of took the worry of that side of things away. But for me personally, trying to obviously stay fit in those times, even though we had a plan, obviously we train longer than an hour a day normally. It was quite difficult to kind of get your head around the fact that you've got to try and get everything you needed to be done in that hour if you're going to be doing it outside. So it was quite difficult. But again, we had a lot of support and a lot of the staff were always on the end of the phone just making sure that we were getting everything we needed. So it wasn't as much of a struggle as what I think some other teams and players and athletes found it for me personally.
Looking at Reading before the start of the season anyway, and
there's a lot of eye-catching signings that have been made. There's yourself, first and foremost. Then you look at the likes of Emma Mitchell, Danielle Carter, Jess Fishlock, obviously stands out as well, to name just a few. So kind of give us a sense, how's the squad actually shaping up ahead of the start of the new season, and what can we ultimately expect from the team when the action gets going?
Yeah, so I think obviously you look at Reading and it's always kind of been, they've always pushed the top teams, but they've never really broken into that top three. And I think from the signings that Kelly's made this year, it kind of shows her ambition to compete even more, and if not get some results against the top teams. And I think the players that have come in have that mentality of they want to be the best. And for that mentality to be around the other players and around the club, I think is really, really good. And I know for me personally, I don't want to be a mid-table team this year. I want to be pushing the top three. And I think that's a good place to be and a good attitude to have, because if you don't want to be the best, then why are you playing? That's kind of my mantra. If you don't want to be competing with the top teams, then what is your goal? Like what do you want to be doing? So for the team and for me personally, like just get as much as we can out of every game. And and just the signings have been unbelievable. Let's face it, like playing against people like Emma Mitchell and Dan Carter have been in the Super League for a long, long time, and then Jess Fishlock, who's an NBE, like most capped Welsh player, it's a great signing. And it's a really exciting time, I think, to be a Reading player, and we're all just looking forward to that first game of the season.
How bold is that move anyway? Because it could be so easy for a club to be happy to be the best of the rest sort of thing. But looking from the outside in anyway, the fact that Reading seem to want to break into that top three, that must be such a major draw for so many players like yourself.
Yeah, definitely. As I say, they've always competed with the top three. Like they've always, I know, being a Chelsea player in the past, playing against Reading was always one of the toughest games of the season, just because of the attitude and the passion of the players, which is also another draw of what made me want to go there. But yeah, Kelly showed a lot of ambition. And again, that was one of the things that drew me to the club. Obviously, I didn't know who the signings were, but I obviously knew that a lot of players had left, so they were going to have to bring some players in. But yeah, it just like knowing that they want to be able to compete with the top teams is something that was a really big draw for me personally when making the decision of where I wanted to come this season. So it was a good choice, I think, for me. At the moment, I feel like it was a good choice.
Definitely. In terms of yourself, what do you think is the main difference between the player that arrived at Chelsea and the player that's arrived at Reading?
That's a big question. The player that arrived at Chelsea, from my point of view, was a nobody. And I know that probably sounds a bit harsh towards myself, but but I was literally a nobody. Nobody knew who I was. Nobody had really seen me play. I only got into Chelsea on trial. And my first contract, I think, was only 3 months long. So I had a short amount of time to kind of prove myself. But that person has grown so much in confidence, and I think just as a human being, I've learned a lot from being at Chelsea, and I feel like now going into Reading, I'm a completely different person to what I was back there. I believe in myself a lot more, I'm a lot more confident, and I feel like I understand who I am a lot better, which has enabled me to hopefully make put a stamp on what I want to do at Reading. So
in terms of understanding like who you are as a person better, is that kind of rooted in the self-confidence side of things, or is there something else that you
kind of... Yeah, definitely. So when I first started at Chelsea, no one knew who I was, and then at the end of the spring series, like people were, including like management and stuff, were saying, oh, she'll get called up for the next England squad and stuff like that, and that kind of is a bit like, whoa, I've gone from no one to all of a sudden people are saying could potentially in the future be an England player, and you're like, what? Sorry. And then obviously I got injured, and that kind of knocked me for six, really. Like I'd never really had an injury like that that put me out. And then by the time I was back fit, Chelsea had kind of replaced me with other people. And so I never really got back into their starting 11. Well, I didn't get back into their starting 11. So that for me, confidence-wise, was hard. But I feel like the players there, they were so good with me, and they just helped me to just train every day and make sure I was focusing on myself rather than other things that were out of my control, basically. So, but I've now learned through the players that were there that if I don't believe in myself, no one else will. So I think that's kind of built up over the last kind of 3 years where I've not really been playing much to be the person I am today and to go into Reading and actually say, actually, I believe in myself and I can do this, which is a really, really good place to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the Spring Series there, and that just seemed to be such a launch pad for you. Just to kind of summarise and background, you were the first WSL player, you will not remember this in any way, shape or form, but you were the first WSL player I ever interviewed. when I was still a trainee reporter, I hadn't even qualified at that point. And I was covering the Yeovil game where you won 6-0, if you remember.
Yeah, that was my first game. That's the first game I started.
There you go. And that's pretty much why we were directed in your direction, because you'd just been such a standout player in that game. And like you say, you just sort of not emerged from nowhere, but had just been the surprise, really.
Yeah.
From that. So, I mean, I think you were described as the surprise package, weren't you?
Yeah.
The end of the Spring Series. So, do you think, was that essentially the best prolonged period of time you've had playing football? Whether that's the level of performances or anything on top of that?
I think the Spring Series for me was, I had almost no pressure on my shoulders. Like, I kind of came in and, as I say, in my own words, I was a nobody. No one expected anything of me. And it was just lucky for me, not lucky for some of the other girls, that there was quite a few injuries at that time. And Emma didn't really have a choice but to play me. She had no other defenders. I remember we played Arsenal, and I'm pretty sure we played two at the back because that's all we had. But it kind of built me up to be who I kind of put me on a pedestal, if you know what I mean, that towards the end of the Spring Series, that where I've never really been before. And I feel like those string of games has set me up to kind of have the footballing career that I've had so far, if that makes sense. Because I kind of went from training twice a week to training full time, and that kind of has put me in a really good place to kind of where I am right now.
The things on that is, we've asked a couple of footballers this before, the move from going part-time training to full-time training, how does that actually impact on your performance? Because so many people argue about giving women's football the resources it deserves, and to me that's a key example of just what could be done if more people had access.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously up until the age of 23, I was part-time, whereas other players in the Chelsea squad, someone like Ramona Backman, I think she turned professional when she was like 13 or something ridiculous. So she's had 10 years on me as a professional footballer. And it shows. So when I first joined Chelsea, I was actually going from part-time to full-time, and it took the whole of the Spring Series really, and then my entire rehab after my ACL to kind of adjust to full-time football. People don't think it's much different, but it's a lot different. Like, you're training every day, you're doing gym every day or every other day kind of thing. And it's a big, big jump, but it does make a huge difference on performance, because you're not, for example, when I was at Brighton, I was working in a school as a supervisor. So I was up at 7, working till 4, driving 2 hours to Brighton, training for 3 hours, driving 2 hours back and getting up and doing the same thing the next day. So it takes out of you working full-time and playing, which obviously still a lot of players in the WSL2 or the Championship, sorry, still do. So being able to just focus on what you're doing and just be a footballer, it makes a huge difference to performance and to the way you are, really.
Yeah, like you say, we've seen it so many times, that jump in level. And I've kind of asked this next question already in regards to the pandemic and having everything stopped beyond your control. But then when the ACL happens after the Spring Series, is that kind of a similar battle that you had to face?
Yeah, it was tough, I'm not going to lie, because I kind of went from being, she'll get called up to the next England squad, to she's out for a year. So it kind of, that hits hard. And I remember after the first, I was very lucky. Well, I wasn't lucky. I did it on the first game of pre-season, which was behind closed doors, which was frustrating in itself. And then 2 weeks later, Emma kind of pulled me in and had a chat with me and basically said, look, like, if you work hard, there's no telling where you're going to end up. And that kind of kicked me on and kept me kind of fighting. And obviously the girls obviously won the double that year. And I played 10 minutes of that season. In the last game of the season, I played 10 minutes or something ridiculous. Which for me was something that kept me fighting. I was like, well, I want a bit of this. I want to be part of that squad and I want to play. But it was literally from high to low. I remember the day after my surgery, just crying. I think my mum was with me, bless her. It was horrible to have it taken away from you. But again, it's another moment where you realise when you get back, you'll never take it for granted, which is how, again, I feel right now. So,
yeah. And to bring in your sister as well, for background, was it 2017 as well, I think?
But yeah.
The crowdfunder for her.
Yes.
Needed surgery for an ACL as well. And that, I think, sadly ended her career as well in terms of the football. I mean, first off, what's the relationship like between the two of you? But then how much of a support was she, considering what she'd been through, to you as well?
To be honest, my sister is basically the other half of me. We literally talk every single day. I don't know where I'd be about her, so let's just give her that credit before. If she listens to this, she'll laugh, but she won't listen to this, I say that. she's just an unbelievable support for me. Like, she's one of those people who will tell you straight no matter what. So if you're having a bit of a bad day and you start moaning, she's like, stop moaning, do something about it. So she's one of those kind of people. And I always take a look out of her about the fact that she's got no emotions, because she's just very, okay, so this has happened, we'll deal with it. She's great like that. And obviously when I done my ACL, she was absolutely gutted for me, because obviously she knew what had gone on in the spring series and stuff like that. But then she was still playing at that point. So it was all very emotional for me. And she was like, no, don't worry, like, we'll get through it, we'll do it. And then literally 2 weeks to the day, I remember her ringing me. I'm sorry, I'm going on a bit, but I remember her ringing me. And she was like, I've done my, on the way back from her training session, she went, I've done my ACL. I went, don't be so stupid. You're like, it's just in your head because I've done it. Blah, 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 blah. And she was like, no, I think I've actually done my ACL. And I was like, oh no. And obviously it was a bit different because I was at Chelsea, I was in a professional environment. I got my surgery literally like that because they were so good there. They looked after me really, really well. She was at a club that didn't. we had to end up, and for her, she was literally just about to start her training to go into the police force. And she was like, I need the surgery. So she couldn't wait for the NHS because she needed to have it done in order to be ready to start her police training. And so we ended up having to crowdfund for it. And luckily, a lot of people put some money towards it. And then my grandparents ended up paying for, and my parents ended up paying for the rest. So she was quite lucky. But that next 8 months where we were both kind of going through rehab was very, very different, but very much the same. Because obviously I was going through it in a professional environment. She was going through it on her own. So a lot of the stuff that I was doing, I was then passing on to her. And the old physio at Chelsea, Aaron, was really, really good in helping, giving exercises to me that I could then give to her. And same with regards to using equipment and stuff. But the support that she gave me, and still does, is unbelievable.
It's another striking example of the difference between professional and those who aren't lucky enough to have it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same injury essentially, but
yeah,
recoverable because you got the right surgery and all things like that. And I imagine she managed to successfully get through the police course as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah, she's
as my sister is also in the police, so I can vouch how tough a program that is.
Yeah.
In terms of successfully coming back from that ACL, is that essentially the biggest challenge you've had to face in terms of football, or is there something else that stands out for you?
In terms of football, yes, injury wise definitely that's the hardest thing I've ever gone through. Luckily I had a really good support system. The physio Aaron Duffy at Chelsea was incredible with me. Like, he was very much, sort yourself out, let's get this done, we can do this kind of thing. So he was really, really good at that sort of thing. And then apart from that, football-wise, it's difficult because when you're coming back from that injury, the next 2 years, was really, I found really, really difficult. Obviously, trying to break back into a Chelsea team that are winning every game is really, really difficult. And obviously, you're giving your all in training every single day and you're just continuously, like, not playing. That can also be really, really hard. But again, I had a great support system in regards to my teammates were fantastic. Like, they some of them would stay out and do extras with me just to make sure that I was getting what I needed. And off the pitch, they were fantastic. That it was always there for me if I ever needed to talk to anyone about how I was feeling and stuff like that. So, yeah.
That, speaking as someone who's watched a fair bit of Chelsea recently, and it's clear to, I think, a lot of people, the absolute winning machine that team is in terms of being there. But it just, first and foremost, seems to be a really good group. And
yeah.
That sounds pretty much like what you're saying, really.
Yeah, so that 2 years, obviously, I don't know what it's like this year. Obviously, they've had a lot of changes, a lot of new signings, a lot of people aren't going to be playing and stuff like that. But last year, the actual players as a group were so close. And I think that really, really helped with regards to, I don't think we lost a game.
No.
So, yeah, I had to think about that then. I don't think we lost a game, but I think the fact that the players were so tight, like even if the players weren't in the squad or weren't playing, like there was no issues within the team at all. So that was actually amazing.
Who's the most underrated player in that team?
Oh, that's a big question. The most underrated, it's hard. I would have said Beth Lindon, but she's started to get the recognition that she deserves now. I'm going to say Sophie Ingle. Because I'm so glad last year against Arsenal when she scored that absolute screamer, she actually got some recognition that she deserved because she's an absolute rock for that team. Just sits in front of the back four and just goes about her business, never really gets any praise or anything, but she just goes about her business. And without her there, I don't think last season would have been the same. So I'm going to say her. Yeah, I'm going to say Sophie Ingle.
Like you say, there's a lot of eye-catching players, obviously, but
also I think as much as Magda's the captain, I don't think she sometimes gets the recognition she deserves because I don't think the people outside of the club see what she does for the players that are within the squad. Like if it weren't for her last year, it would have been so tough for me, but she was literally behind me every step of the way if I needed anything, and I can't ever thank her enough for that. So she's probably another one that I think, obviously people see what she does on the pitch, but the stuff that she does behind the pitch, she doesn't get the recognition she deserves for that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I teed that question up primarily because I wrote an article about the most underrated player in the league. I think it was back in January for the offside rule.
Yeah.
I said it was Guro Wrighton.
To be fair, she's just unbelievable. She's such a nice girl as well. But I suppose sometimes she does get the recognition she deserves as well, a little bit. But she works so hard. She works so hard in training and in games. And I suppose she is a bit underrated, to be fair. Although she was up for player of the season, so people must have.
It was back in January. It's probably out there.
You're listening to the Women's Football Diary. Join the conversation on social media using hashtag Women's Football Diary.
The challenge on its head, best highlight in terms of football?
Oh, for me? Mm-hmm. Oh, obviously for me. I'm the only one here. my best highlight? I'm going to say there's two. Do you want me to pick one?
No, you can pick two. I'll be nice.
Okay, pick two. So my first one was signing my first professional contract. I'd been working for that for obviously I've played football since I was 11 years old, and obviously I was a cricketer, but when I decided to go from cricket to football properly, that was my goal, and me and my old manager worked really hard towards that. So that was a big, big thing. When Chelsea turned around and said, look, we're offering you a 3-month contract, I cried my eyes out. I probably made myself look really stupid, but oh well. And the second one was obviously, I think, the first trophy I won with Chelsea. The spring series, because I played a big part in it, and I just felt like that was the kind of summed up all the hard work that I put in up to that point. So those probably are my two, although someone's going to listen to this and say, well, what about this? But yeah, that, and also playing my first game with my sister, but we used to play together when we was at Brighton, so that was quite
cool. Those are good highlights.
Yeah.
Moving on slightly then, and you've already alluded to it, so this is perfectly linked, and that's cricket.
Yeah.
How close are we to seeing Deanna Cooper, the cricketer, rather than the footballer?
Pretty damn close, I'm not going to lie. So pretty much my whole time, I was always a cricketer and then football was a hobby. Pretty much my entire life, really. So I made my like Kent debut at the age of 13. Got into the England Academy when I was 14 or 15, something like that. So I was really young. But yeah, it was very close. If I hadn't have got a stress fracture in my back, I'm going to say if that hadn't have happened, then I probably would have been playing cricket, hopefully as a professional right now. I can't say that for sure because things change and stuff. But if that hadn't have happened, I probably would have been playing cricket and not football. I probably would have been playing football Sunday league still. So
there could be an alternate universe somewhere.
Yeah, there could be.
Who knows? And does that background in cricket help in some ways with the football, whether it's the training side of it or if there's complementary skills, things like that?
Yeah, because obviously I think cricket's very individual, and you have to have a lot of kind of self-motivation when it comes to cricket. So I was very lucky that when I got put into the boys academy, I say boys academy, it's not really the boys academy, it's the Kent Cricket Academy, and there's a couple of girls on it and the rest of the boys. When I got put in with that group, it kind of, that and the guy that was leading it, Simon Willis, really helped in helping me to find my self-motivation. And again, I think that's really helped me with my football, especially going through your rehab when you see all the girls going out to training and you're stuck in the gym. That's probably the one thing that I've taken from my cricket mainly to my football, is that cricket is very individualised and very, you have to do everything yourself kind of things. You have to take yourself to the nets, you have to do this, you have to do that. Whereas football is always very team-based. But some of the stuff that I've had to take over has definitely been switched between, which has been really helpful.
And certainly must be helpful when you have to self-motivate for those individual training plans during a pandemic and all that.
Definitely. Definitely.
To throw a third sport into the mix is trampolining as well, which just sport seems to dominate your life, really. Yeah. I mean, how has sport helped you grow as a person? Because it's clearly quite an important thing to you.
Yeah, so growing up, my parents were always sporty, but they'll self-admit that they were never really very good at anything. But they always played it and they always enjoyed it. And I think because of that, I've got an older brother and a younger sister. When my older brother was growing up, he ended up, I think he played county football, county cricket. And I don't know if he played county hockey, but he definitely played hockey at a high level, where he played like top level at university. So, and then my sister played county football as well. And then obviously I was playing county football, county cricket. So there was a lot of sport going on in our family. And I think I've just been brought up in that environment of, just, I was very lucky in fact, my parents never pushed us to do anything we didn't want to do. So for example, at the end of a game, instead of my dad saying, did you win? Did you do this? He would always ask, we always take the mick out of him now, because his favorite word was effort. He's like, how much effort did you put in? Did you work hard? And that's all he cared about. He didn't care about if I won 6-0 and scored all six goals. He just wants to know if I work my bum off, basically. That's all he cared about, because he wanted us to do things that we wanted to do. And I think that kind of is something that, again, I've taken my whole way through my career. And even now, when I'm going off to the games, we always joke about him saying, oh, did you put the effort in? And that's all he ever wants. That's all he's ever wanted from us. Just make sure that if it's something we want to do, just make sure we work for it. And that's kind of been my core, again, another core mantra for me going through my career.
Well, if your dad's going to have a catchphrase, make it.
Yeah.
No, that's definitely a good one to have.
Yeah.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for @SportspielPod on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram.
For kind of the last section of this chat, I'm going to try and pick out a few sort of women's sport specific topics that I've asked. quite a few people about now, but because they're kind of topical. One of the ones that's come up recently, I've touched on it in a couple of past interviews, is the from the BBC Sport Elite Sport. The BBC Sport Elite Sportswomen Survey, which came out 2 weeks ago, which I'm not sure if you got to read through any of the results or saw any of the sort of the headline grabbers, if you like. But basically, from the sportswomen who took part in the survey, 78% of them, which was a really striking number to me, said that they felt self-conscious about their body image at some point. To me, that's an incredibly sort of striking number, not just in terms of the elite sportswomen side of things, but just, I suppose, women in general, really. And when you look at Instagram and the pressures of society and things like that. So is that something that you've seen in football, whether it's personal or maybe struggles that other people have gone through, whether that's something that needs to be addressed, maybe not necessarily in football, but I suppose in society in general?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really important subject. I think a lot of women in general in society are very worried about what they look like, and it doesn't help that a lot of the stuff that you see on Instagram or on Twitter or on social media in general is not actually, like, you look at someone and that's not actually what they actually look like. It's been edited, which I think for young girls growing up at the moment is really difficult for them to see, because they're seeing things that aren't really true, which is why I think it's really important for sports people and professionals in the sporting world, especially females, to show who they are. And I think a lot of the players at the moment are doing a really, really good job of kind of putting on their social media stuff to show that it's okay to be, or as I say, there's a thing going around at the moment, isn't there, that it's okay to be, not to be okay. And I think, especially with regards to body image, for a female, it's a very personal thing. And the way you perceive yourself is sometimes not the way others perceive you. So I think it's really important. It's a really important subject, and it's really important for girls to kind of back each other up and on stuff like that, and to actually just be positive about things and not have to worry about being perfect. I think there's a lot of stigmatism about perfectionism within the way someone's meant to look. But as I say, I've personally maybe struggled a little bit with it, but not really to a point where I've had to actually worry about it. So, but yeah, it's an important thing, especially for younger girls that are going into the sporting world. Obviously, the good thing for them now is that they're seeing like people like Frank Kirby and Sam Kerr and all Steph Houghton on big billboards in their sporting like football kits and stuff like that, which I think is really important for people to see. So they're not just seeing all these models and stuff like that who don't actually even look like that. So I think that's really, really important.
That I think this is about 2 or 3 days ago. You mentioned seeing the players in their kit on billboards and things like that. And the Irish rugby team released their new jersey this week, and the men's players modelled the shirt, but they got models to do the female shirt. And that was exactly the same sort of argument people were having, is that why didn't you get the women's players to be part of the campaign?
I think that's happened a couple of times with a couple of different companies that have done that, and you're kind of like, well, hang on a minute, why are you getting models to do it when you've got athletes who are perfectly willing to go up there and be the person in the kit? I think that's bad, really, but I mean, they've obviously got a reason, and I'd quite like to know what it was, to be fair.
Do you want to dive on that one? I suppose throwing it out wider, because we've talked about specifically with the social media stuff and the amount of sexism that you can see on there with regards to women's sport, is there, and using that jersey example as one, is there a constant frustration sometimes that women's sport and women's football sometimes gets overlooked when it really, really shouldn't?
Yeah, I think the good thing for women's football is it's making big strides. I think it's every year it gets better and better. Obviously, it's nowhere near where it needs to be. But I think, again, somewhere like Chelsea and obviously now Reading, I think you see that there is effort being made to kind of close that gap. Obviously, Chelsea have been using the men's ground, or they say men's ground, they weren't allowed to call that anymore. It's the Chelsea training facility. But same with Reading, obviously, we're going to the Reading Football Club ground soon as a training facility. So I think it's, there's a lot of work that needs to be done still, a hell of a lot of work that needs to be done actually, but there are small strides being made, which is important because it can't just stop. You can't just say, well, okay, that's enough now. Let's leave women's sport there. No, women's sport continues, needs to continue to grow and then continue to improve. And it is continuously doing that, which I think is fantastic. But again, there is a lot of strides that need to be made to make it, the gap smaller. Definitely. And we will one day.
Yeah, exactly, one day. Long may that progress continue as well. Yeah. Kind of looking at the influence it can have, particularly on young girls, children, whoever. And I suppose you look now and you've got so many role models in women's football that people have to look up to. Was that something you had when you were growing up, where you had that female sports role model to look up to? Or was that maybe missing a little bit? Or
I mean, again, if any of my teammates listen to this, they're probably going to laugh. But the only I had, you had women's football that was on telly like once a year. So the people that you looked up to when I was young was more like that one footballer you saw like once a year. So I think Arsenal were great when I was younger. So I think Faye White was someone I really liked. And I'm not going to lie, I had a poster of Farrah Williams on my wall. Now she's my teammate, which I'm still a bit nervous about. I'm not going to lie. No, she doesn't know about that. But hopefully she skips that bit if she listens to this podcast. But yeah, so those two were probably... And obviously, when I was that age, football was kind of a hobby. So my cricket, my idols growing up were people like Charlotte Edwards. But she was also my captain, so it was weird. So I was kind of playing with my idol at that point in regards to cricket. But apart from that, all my other role models within sport were male. And my main one was my brother. So I always wanted to be him. I wanted to be him, basically.
Does it... Well, now, listening back to that, does it feel a little bit weird essentially being a role model to others?
Yeah, I still find it quite strange when, for example, when I was at Chelsea, there was people like young girls like wearing kits with our names on the back and people wanting you to send shirts out or just wanting to send boots out and things like that. And I'm kind of like, well, it's like, it's just me. Like, I still, even in my mind sometimes, I still think I'm a nobody. So I'm like, why do they want my shirt? But yeah, it is a bit odd knowing that there's so many young people who are aspiring to be where I am right now, which is, it's quite cool to look at it like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, in terms of the social media side of it, like you mentioned it before about the importance of showing the good side and the bad side as well. Is that something mm-hmm. that for you is easy to... I'm not sure how much you want to use it, because for some people it can be take a lot of time and energy, I think, to keep up a social media account that much. But is it easy enough for you to share the good and the bad sides on that?
To be honest, for me, it's probably something I still need to work on. I tend to try and be quite positive with regards to what I put on my social media in general. I tend to always kind of stick to like football on there. Like every now and again I'll put like what I'm doing, maybe just chilling at home and stuff like that. But a lot of the stuff that I do put on my social media relates to my professional career. I don't tend to be one that kind of puts my entire social life and family life on social media. And that's just a personal choice. It's not for any particular reason. It's just when I'm with my family and when I'm with my friends, I tend to want to spend time with them rather than going on social media. So it's something I probably need to work on personally. But I know there's a lot of girls out there that are really, really good with their social media and they put stuff, the good and the bad, on. But personally, I always tend to stick to a lot of the positive stuff because I think there's enough negativity in the world. I don't need to be hearing it from me.
Yeah, definitely. I'll back that. I think it's, to me anyway, it's almost like an individual choice as well. It works for some people putting everything out there and it doesn't work for other people. And that's just the way it is, really. Mm-hmm. Considering the push that women's football has had, particularly in, say, the last year, when you look at the number of games that were held in the main stadiums, whether it was the Stamford Bridge game right at the start of last season, I went to the London Stadium game to watch West Ham Spurs. How important is it that we keep that momentum going, because if you do read around a little bit, I think there's maybe a bit of apprehension, worry that for whatever reason women's sport, women's football gets left behind a little bit because of who knows what may come out of the pandemic. But supposed to keep having those stadium showcases and keep pushing the product, really. And I suppose specifically for Reading, it's great that there are going to be more games in the Medeiros Stadium as well.
Yeah, I think it's really, really important to keep working on stuff like that. But again, at the moment, it's like one or two games a season, three if you're lucky. So I think the fact that Reading themselves have made a really big effort to say, no, the women are going to be playing at the Medeiros is fantastic. I think that's a great move from them. And for us as a club, in order for our fans to come and watch and to build that fan base, which again is really, really important in women's football, that it's massive, because obviously you're at the stadium, you're at the men's stadium or the football stadium. I think that's really, really important. I think if we let it, women's football could get left behind, but I think it's important, and it's the responsibility of the players that are here now and also the staff that are all around the country, and also in regards to like the FA and stuff. I think it's up to the people that are in women's football now to not let that happen and to make sure that we keep striving to be bigger and better, because there's no reason if we continue to grow that we can't be the best league in the world, really. Which I think we're not far, well, in my opinion, I think we are, but in other people's opinion, I don't think they believe that that's quite true yet, but I think in the future it's definitely a possibility.
It's either there already or it's about to be.
Exactly.
I suppose for women's footballers particularly, does there feel like an extra sense of responsibility to the product that, say, the men's side of the game doesn't really have to contend with?
Yeah, 100%. Like being at Chelsea last year, I know Emma Hayes is a massive influencer when it comes to growing the women's game, and she quite often would encourage us to be part of that as well. And I think a lot of the players last year were really, really good. Like you got people like Anita Asante and Karen Carney and all those players that are making big strides in women's football, and making sure that they take that responsibility, which then encourages the rest of the team and the rest of the players. But for me personally, I do feel that there's a big responsibility to make sure that we are showing, even if it's just on the pitch, make sure we are showing that women's football is progressing. And I think that's a really important thing, to keep the standards high, even if sometimes you are being judged for the wrong reasons. If we make sure that we're doing the right things, then people can comment all they like, to be honest, but as long as we know we're doing the right things, that's all that matters most.
Football's football. So many other things.
It's a game of opinions in every way. So,
you just need to go on Twitter for 5 seconds. You learn that very quickly. In terms of then this season, which will have started by the time this airs, but early days. Dream scenario, if you can think, say, fast forward to 12 months' time, and you can think specifically about yourself and the team, what would you have liked to have accomplished in that time?
I'm going to say I'd love a top three finish, but I think, yeah, I'm going to say it, top three finish. I believe that we have a squad that can do that. Obviously, the new 5-sub rule aids some teams more than others, but anyway, I could go on about that for ages. And personally, I just want to play football. I just want to get back to playing regular football and enjoying it. And that's kind of the only goal I have set myself for this season, is to play with confidence, play with a smile on my face, and just enjoy football.
Is it going to take some getting used to with the new circumstances, if you like, for the first few weeks or couple of weeks?
Yes, I think so. I think everyone's still adapting to a lot of the different changes that have been made, especially due to COVID. I think obviously we're all still getting tested and things like that. So you can literally go from being in a starting 11 to not being allowed to even train for a week, like things like that. You've also got new rules that are coming in. You've got a lot of changes that have been made. So I think I even think it could take up till Christmas until everything starts to, you start to get, feel a sense of being settled. But I know for us, we're doing everything that we possibly can in order to make sure that we are flying come that first game of the season. So
definitely,
this comes out how that sounds.
It'll only be like a week old by the time. So I doubt if you happen to lose the first game of the season, I don't think it's curtained somehow. Last thing, you mentioned sort of the talk about potential England squad after the summer series. I think you know what question is going to come as to whether that's still, I suppose, the ultimate achievement, if that's what your aim is.
I mean, I think that's every player's aim. I don't think there's a player in the WSL that's English that doesn't want to play for England. And I've said that for a long time. I've always wanted to play for England. Well, in some respect, whether it be in cricket or football, I've always wanted to play for England and represent my country. We'll see what happens. Like you can't say never. Like, I might have an absolute worldie of a season, and it might happen. I might not. Like, who knows? But it is the ultimate goal. And again, I'm not afraid to say that. I think most players will say that they want to play for England, and if they don't, you kind of sometimes have to question a little bit why they don't want to play for England. If you're playing football, and I'm not young, but I'm only 27, and I think I've still got a long way to go in my career, and I'm learning every day, and why not? Why can that not be a goal? So, but we're focusing on enjoying every game at the moment.
And you're definitely still young, because I turn 28 in 2 weeks. Please say that. With that then, that brings an end to this particular episode of the podcast. So thank you so much, Deanna, for coming on and having a chat. I think we picked out quite a few different things there, whether it's football, body image, and the importance of your family as well, coming back. So I'm sure I and everyone else who's listening to this will look forward to seeing what Reading does this particular season. And I do hope that Farrah Williams does find out you that poster at some stage. So.
I mean, I was like 12 at the time. But thank you very much for having me on.
No, thank you so much.
The Women's Football Diary is brought to you by Sport Spiel. You can join the conversation and spread the word using hashtag Women's Football Diary now on social media. You can follow Sportspiel on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram using the handle at SportspielPod, and visit our website, which is sportspielonline.com. The Women's Football Diary will return next Friday with a brand new episode featuring former Wolfsburg, FC Rosengard and PSG forward Ella Massa.